lands, where the term Peiland clearly means lands reclaimed from the sea. Thus we read how the Sheptiwa recited sacred spells, the water gradually receded from the edge of the island, and the actual land of the Peiland was brought out. The texts then describe a process of continuous creation by the emergence of a progressive series of plots of land. The creation of these sacred domains was, in fact, a resurrection and restoration of what had been in the past but had vanished. At the end, there appeared further Peilands, which brought to a new life the former homeland. Nonetheless, despite these efforts, the fact remained that the cataclysm had so utterly devastated the primeval island that no amount of reclamation could restore it to its former glory. The only solution for the survivors, therefore, was to attempt to recreate it elsewhere, in regions that had not been as badly affected by the catastrophe. The result saw the beginning of a great project of which the world we live in today is the result. What the Edfu texts say, explains Raymond, is that the gods left the original Peilands. They sailed to another part of the primeval world and journeyed through the lands of the primeval age. In any place in which they settled, they founded new, sacred domains. Their mission, in short, was to re-promulgate the lost civilization and the lost religion of the days before the flood. As Raymond puts it, this second era of the primeval age saw the development of the domains that survived in historical times. Begin again like children. The Edfu texts make allusion to the Smud, wandering of the company of gods, who initiated the civilizing project. Their leader was the falcon Horus, after whom the temple at Edfu was much later dedicated. But present also was Thoth, the god of wisdom. Accompanying Horus and Thoth were the Sheptiwa, a group of deities charged with a specific responsibility for creation, the builder gods, who accomplished the actual work of building, and the seven sages. This is a matter of interest in the light of the Mesopotamian traditions of the Apkalus, explored in Chapter 8, and it seems that something more than coincidence is involved. The reader will recall that the Apkalus were often depicted as hybrid creatures, part bird of prey, part human in appearance. Similarly, the seven sages of the Edfu texts are described as primeval deities who were capable of assuming the form of falcons and resembling falcons. Also, exactly like the antediluvian Apkalus, the seven sages of the Edfu texts, who are not mentioned elsewhere in ancient Egyptian inscriptions, were the magicians amongst the gods. They were the seers who could foretell the future, and they could endue with power the substances of the earth. A process of creation, by the word of the creators that Raymond notes, has no equivalent. They were, in addition, believed to have the ability to magnify things, and thus to provide magical protection. On this point, the best sense Raymond is able to make of what she describes as an unusually obscure text is that the protection was constituted by means of symbols. The magical power of protecting was conferred by a giving of names. The Apkalus mingled their magic with practical skills, such as laying the foundations of cities and temples. Similarly, the seven sages of the Edfu texts also had their practical architectural side. And many passages testify to their involvement in the setting out and construction of buildings and in the laying of foundations. Moreover, the Egyptians believed that the ground plans of the historical temples were established according to what the sages of the primeval age revealed to Thoth. This hint of a special connection between the sages and Thoth is, of course, a further parallel, for as we've seen, the Apkalus were linked to Enki, the Mesopotamian god of wisdom. In the Mesopotamian inscriptions, however, Enki is clearly superior to the sages. Indeed, he is their maker. But in the Edfu texts, strangely, it appears that the knowledge of the sages is regarded as superior to that of the wisdom god Thoth. Indeed, it was the tradition at Edfu that the original records and archives from which the texts were extracted were nothing less than the words of the sages, given as dictation to Thoth, who had then consigned them to writing. The texts further disclose that the sages of the mythical age were believed to be the only divine beings who knew how the temples and sacred places were created, and were themselves the very creators of knowledge, which thereafter could only be passed on, but not invented anew. This finds parallels in the Mesopotamian notion that since the time of the antediluvian Apkallus, nothing new had been invented, with the original revelation simply being retransmitted and unfolded in later epochs. Without laboring the point further, therefore, it seems to me that the idea conveyed so strongly in the cuneiform inscriptions of ancient Mesopotamia, of a project to recover and re-promulgate antediluvian knowledge after a global cataclysm, is rather exactly the same project that is set out in the Edfu building texts, which in turn bear uncanny and troubling resemblances to Plato's report of the destroyed Ice Age civilization of Atlantis. More than that, the Edfu texts invite us to consider the possibility that the survivors of the lost civilization, thought of as gods but manifestly human, albeit with mysterious powers, set about wandering the world after the flood. By happenstance, it was only hunter-gatherer populations, the peoples of the mountains and the deserts, the unlettered and the uncultured, as Plato so eloquently put it in his Timaeus, who had been spared the scourge of the deluge. But the civilizers entertained the desperate hope, if their mission would succeed, that mankind might not have to begin again like children, in complete ignorance of what happened in early times. The evidence of the Mesopotamian inscriptions and of Göbekli Tepe, to which we will return, is that the mountain lands of ancient Armenia and eastern Turkey were amongst the primal wildernesses to which the civilizers made their way after the flood. But the testimony of Edfu is that they also came to the Nile flowing in its fertile valley through the deserts of Egypt. Moreover, the building texts say very clearly which part of Egypt they came to first. And it was not Edfu, as we'll see in the next chapter. Chapter 10, Monastery of the Seven Sages. In his Timaeus, we've seen how Plato speaks of events described in ancient Egyptian temple records that took place 9,000 years before the time of Solon, in other words, in 9,600 BC. Nor is the Timaeus the only place where Plato alludes to such vast antiquity. In his Laws, for example, he says of the ancient Egyptians, "If you examine their art on the spot, you will find that 10,000 years ago, and I'm not speaking loosely, I mean literally 10,000, paintings and reliefs were produced that are no better and no worse than those of today." It's interesting how the Greek philosopher makes a point of this 10,000 years ago, emphasizing that he's not speaking loosely, that he really means it. But we live supposedly in a more scientific age with the benefit of objective dating techniques, so what are we to make of such a chronology? Plato was born around 428 BC, so his reference to 10,000 years ago translates to around 10,400 BC in our calendar, within a whisker of the date of 10,450 BC that I proposed in Fingerprints of the Gods for the remote epoch, Zeptepi, the first time, when the ancient Egyptians believed that the gods walked the earth and the civilization of the Nile Valley had its true beginnings. The date, based on findings that arose from research underlying the Orion mystery, my friend Robert Boval's groundbreaking 1994 study of the astronomical aspects of the world-famous pyramids of Giza in Egypt, was developed further by the two of us in 1996 in our co-authored book, Keeper of Genesis, titled The Message of the Sphinx in the US. In brief, the date arises from the extraordinarily precise layout of the principal monuments of the Giza Plateau, and the relationship of these monuments to certain stars in the sky. For full details, I refer the reader to Fingerprints of the Gods and to Keeper of Genesis, where this issue is explored in depth. But the heart of the matter lies in the fact that the positions of the stars in the sky are not fixed and finite, but change very gradually over a great cycle, known to astronomers as the precessional cycle, that unfolds in a period of 25,920 years. The cycle is the result of a motion of the Earth itself, a slow, circular wobble of the planet's axis of rotation, unfolding at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years. Since the Earth is the viewing platform from which we observe the stars, these changes in orientation inevitably affect the positions and rising times of all stars as viewed from Earth. Our pole star, for example, around which the remainder of the heavens appear to revolve, is simply the star at which the Earth's extended axis, passing through the geographical North Pole, points most directly. Presently, it is Polaris, Alpha Ursae Minoris, in the constellation of the Little Bear. But the effect of precession is to change the pole star over very long periods of time. Thus, around 3000 BC, just before the start of the Pyramid Age in Egypt, the pole star was Thuban, Alpha Draconis in the constellation of Draco. At the time of the Greeks, it was Beta Ursae Minoris. In AD 14,000, it will be Vega. Sometimes, in this long cyclical journey, the extended north pole of the Earth will point at empty space, and then there will be no useful pole star. The most dramatic, and indeed beautiful and aesthetically pleasing effects of precession, however, are those observed at the horizon on the March equinox, when night and day are of equal length, and when the sun rises perfectly due east, against the background of the 12 constellations of the zodiac. The rate of change is the same as at the pole, in other words, just 1 degree every 72 years, so it cannot easily be observed, let alone measured, in a single human lifetime. But if yours is a culture that keeps careful records over very long periods, it will be noted that the zodiacal constellation that houses the sun on that special day, marking the beginning of spring in the northern hemisphere, does indeed very slowly shift along the horizon until eventually the next constellation takes its place. Broadly speaking, the sun spends 2,160 years in each house of the zodiac, 30 degrees by 72 years, and since there are 12 zodiacal houses, the result is that the great year, the full precessional cycle, unfolds in 12 times 2,160 years, in other words, 25,920 years, at which point the cycle is back at its starting point and a new great year begins. In the sun's annual path through the zodiac, spending approximately 1 month in each sign, as all of us who check our horoscopes are aware, Aquarius is followed by Pisces, which in turn is followed by Aries, which is followed by Taurus, then Gemini, then Cancer, then Leo, etc., etc. But the slow, majestic, precessional course of the sun through the great year is a backwards motion that unfolds in exactly the opposite direction, thus Leo, Cancer, Gemini, Taurus, Aries, Pisces, Aquarius, with each month being 2,160 years in length. So, to give some specific examples, it is not an accident that the early Christians used the fish as their symbol, since the constellation of Pisces housed the sun on the spring equinox from the very beginning of the Christian era until today. Nor is the famous song wrong to state that we live in the dawning of the age of Aquarius, for the early 21st century does indeed stand in the astrological no man's land near the end of the age of Pisces and on the threshold of the new age of Aquarius. Going back before the age of Pisces, we come to the age of Aries, 2330 BC to 170 BC, when, in ancient Egypt, rams were the dominant symbolic motif, for example, the ram-headed sphinxes at the Temple of Karnak in Luxor, and before that to the age of Taurus, 4490 BC to 2330 BC, when the cult of the Apis bull was initiated as early as the First Dynasty, or perhaps before. Different astrologers and astronomers might choose to move the constellation boundaries a few degrees, and thus a century or two, in one direction or another. but the general schema is well understood, and the dates given above stand as a good approximation to the facts. Moving back in time further, as it is easy to do with modern computer programs that simulate ancient skies, we come eventually to the age of Leo, when the constellation of Leo, the lion, housed the sun on the spring equinox. This astrological age spans the period between 10,970 BC and 8,810 BC, although again, depending on where one sets the constellation boundaries, the dates might be pushed back or forward by a couple of centuries. What is clear, however, even with a little boundary juggling, is that the age of Leo pretty much perfectly encloses the younger Dryas, 10,800 to 9,600 BC, something that I was unaware of when I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods. And it was, of course, also the age of Leo that I signaled in Fingerprints as the most likely candidate for the remote epoch that the ancient Egyptians called Zeptepi, the first time. Again, I refer readers to Fingerprints and to Keeper of Genesis and to my later book Heaven's Mirror for more detailed discussions of the astronomical facts and of the ideas behind them. The essence of the argument, however, is that there was an ancient, globally distributed doctrine, as above, so below, that set out quite deliberately to create monuments on the ground that copied the patterns of certain significant constellations in the sky. Moreover, since the positions of all stars change slowly but continuously as a result of the precession, it is possible to use particular configurations of astronomically aligned monuments to deduce the dates that they represent, in other words, the dates when the stars were last in the positions depicted by the monuments on the ground. The Giza Plateau contains the world's most striking array of astronomically aligned monuments, and for purposes of clarity, let me emphasize that these alignments have nothing to do with compass directions. The north indicated by a compass is magnetic north, which can vary by 10 degrees or more from true north, and wanders constantly because of magnetic changes in the Earth's core. True north is the geographical north pole of the Earth, in other words, the pivot of our planet's axis of rotation. From it, true south, east and west are derived. It is therefore significant that the gaze of the Great Sphinx is perfectly targeted on true east, while the three Great Pyramids are aligned with uncanny precision to true north and south. Indeed, the error in the case of the Great Pyramid is just 3/60ths of a single degree. What this tells us is that all these monuments were set out using astronomy, for it is not possible to achieve such precision by any other means. In other words, even if there were no additional astronomical characteristics present, we would have to say, on grounds of accuracy of alignment alone, that astronomers had been at work here. But in fact, there are many other astronomical characteristics, not only in the monuments themselves, but also in ancient Egyptian scriptures such as the pyramid texts. And for these, since I wish to avoid unnecessary repetition, I again refer the reader to my earlier books. The heart of the matter, however, involves two constellations: the constellation of Leo, rising due east above the sun at dawn on the spring equinox in the epoch of 10,500 BC, and the constellation of Orion, which the ancient Egyptians visualized as the celestial figure of the god Osiris, the deceased god-king who ruled over the afterlife kingdom known as the Duat. As we saw in Chapter 9, Osiris was also believed in some way to be the Ka, the double or spiritual essence of the pyramids of Giza. I will not vex the reader with lengthy substantiations of the assertions that follow, since they are fully backed up, referenced, and documented in my earlier books, but an uncanny sky-ground lock occurs at Giza in the epoch of 10,500 BC. I had opted for a date 50 years later, 10,450 BC, in Fingerprints, but such minor details are not really significant, since the stellar changes are so slow, even within a single astrological age, that the same general configuration holds good for many centuries. Indeed, it's true to say that the Giza sky-ground lock stays in place throughout most, if not all, of the Younger Dryas, from 10,800 BC down to 9,600 BC. Effectively, therefore, the epoch of the first time, which I will continue for ease of reference to refer to as the epoch of 10,500 BC, is the epoch of the Younger Dryas, and while it was a time of freezing temperatures